On this week's show, can technology help leadership find and prevent burnout with Eitan Vesely from Watercooler and a very special news segment.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, I'm back. Nathan, it seems like I just saw you, man.
Long time no see.
Yeah, long time no see, guys. How we doing?
Oh, man, staying busy. Excited to dig into this.
Oh, I know. Both of us have been really excited. We're going to jump straight in. Eitan, thanks for sitting down with us today.
Thank you guys for having me here and for speaking about such an important topic that is often left unspoken in many ways.
Yeah, it's really overlooked. So this is one of those ones where we're going to remove the mystery, so to speak, behind how we have this guest and why Eitan's with us today. You guys may remember a few episodes back, Nathan and I covered an article by Simon Sinek about engagement and burnout and kind of someone being able to produce data to change Simon's mind from realizing that he may have been pushing people out of being engaged, you know, because he wasn't allowing them to work after hours or outside of normal hours or on the weekend. And, you know, a company was able to produce some data that helped him realize, wait, there are these healthy margins that show engagement. We're going to dig into all of that, but that article was about Eitan's company, Watercooler. And it was about the data that he and his team brought to Simon and are bringing to industries outside of construction. And I remember when that episode ended, Nathan, I told you, I'm going to go get him. I'm going to get him and I'm going to introduce him to construction. So I did. And I got lucky enough that Eitan and the team were gracious enough to, well, what is this guy talking about? To sit down and talk for a half an hour and now we've got an episode. So introduce yourself, Eitan. Let people know a little bit about you. And let's get digging into this really important topic.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, I think tying myself to construction. So I grew up with my father, who had his own engineering firm doing waterproofing consultancy work. So I spent a lot of time walking around construction sites. And I remember myself walking in World of Concrete, which is a big expo. In several years. Later, I went to mechanical engineering school and I got my first work out of school working as a maintenance engineer, a support engineer, helping customers with failing machinery. And I have to say that age 29, after a couple of years working for that company in the semiconductors industry, I actually ended up almost in the hospital with chest pains. And this is where I got myself familiarize with burnout and stress. Working as a frontline engineer, supporting customers, angry customers, usually in complex troubleshooting. Now, I have to say that that was my first encounter with burnout. Up until that moment, I thought that could never happen to me. I'm the strongest person alive, right? I can do everything. I can work 24/7 as long as it's needed. And as long as our customers had machines that were not working, I was there. 15, 18 hours a day. Yeah.
29, nothing can beat you at 29, right?
Exactly, exactly. Until it does. Continuing just a few more lines on that or sentences, I then started my own company in AI for predictive maintenance. So here I am, first-time entrepreneur, using AI to predict failures in industrial machinery. Extreme stress, extreme workload. Ended up in the hospital again with ulcerative colitis, which is all related to stress. Lucky enough to sell that company. I sold it late in 2019. And just a couple of years ago, even less than that, started Watercooler out of the internal wish that people will not end up in hospitals because of the work-related stress anymore.
you went through the burnout phase, but you also grew from frontline to, you know, running a company and having those people's, I'd say futures in your hands. And then you sold that company. And if I understand, I think you went along with it for a period of time and Correct. Even saw some more of what going from a smaller, again, into that larger world looks like.
Yeah, definitely. And I think along that journey, there are two more data points or, you know, encounters that made me start Watercooler out of my own personal pain. The first one was that before the acquisition, we were about 30, 35 people in my company, and we have invested so much, tons of resources and development and making sure that our servers, you know, the service doesn't crash for the customers. Putting monitoring systems in place and, I don't know, thousands of lines of code and dashboards presenting the workload and the temperature and every KPI on computers. And one day I just thought to myself, how come we're investing so much in managing the load on the computer servers and we're doing nothing to look at the load, manage the load, balance the load on our people? Now, if a server crashes, nobody dies. So that was the first thing. Then you're right, Jeff. After the acquisition, I spent almost 2.5 years as a senior director in a, you know, 45,000 employees corporate. It's called SKF. People here may have heard about it. One of the largest bearing manufacturers. And back then, I had a global team, sales and marketing people, you know, starting from Latin America, North America, Europe, and Middle East. And it just wasn't enough for me to have an initial insight into how are my people doing only once a year and only based on self-reporting in the employee survey. I was like, guys, you just bought an AI company, my company. How come there is no real-time data that we can look at that shows me how are my people doing? And it was the pandemic time, right? So connecting all of those, and again, out of the purpose that people shouldn't be dying because of work-related stress. I was struggling to live with that thought. This is why we started Watercooler.
I mean, Nathan, you got something there?
You mentioned employee satisfaction surveys, and we've talked about this in the past. Is like, you know, it is a touch point, is a data point of information, but even that is something that in this industry is frankly pretty rare to find. I mean, my former general contractor would do them, but I guess. Is this in on top of an ESS? Is it replacing an ESS? Like, help me understand, like, kind of what the user experience is for how you're capturing the information.
The answer would be related to timing or putting on a timeline. Today, we're on top. We're an additional continuous real-time data points on top of the annual or pulse surveys. They're important because they do kind of bring the people's voice rather than just the data. And I strongly believe in the combination of the passive listening, which is looking at the data trends an organization is generating, with active listening, which is asking the people, whether in a survey or in an interview. But I think that as time we go by and you see the trend, everything is getting more and more data-driven. I strongly believe that in the not too far future, it would be mostly the passive listening part.
Passive listening for engagement. I guess, can you be more specific? Yeah, like, give me an example of what that looks like, because that's really intriguing.
Simple example. When I had enough, or I saw that my passion is no longer, you know, being with SKF, that big corporate that acquired us, but it's more in the entrepreneurial space, I suddenly started to notice that I'm less active, less responsive. You know, my manager, I don't have to respond in 5 minutes. I can respond in an hour or two, or it can wait for tomorrow. So it occurred to me that my digital footprint has changed. My behavioral pattern, as it was captured in various IT systems, has changed. Now, I have to say that when you look at a team level with 5-10 people in it, and you start comparing one team's behavior to another and a team's behavior over time. And when I say behavior, is as it's captured in various different IT systems, in HR systems, you're suddenly starting to see patterns. Workload increasing dramatically, something that wasn't there a few months ago. People starting to be more and more active or less and less active beyond business hours. New hires, onboarding. Onboarding is a stressful situation. You're getting to a new company, you don't know anyone there, you don't know the job that you were hired to do, you're still not well educated on that. It's a stressful event. And you see in the data successful onboarding processes and unsuccessful onboarding processes.
Man, I'm going to go down a little bit of rabbit hole here because I really want to get your thoughts on the whole, we'll just call it big brother, you know, kind of feeling and stigma or whatever of, yes, like there are obviously a ton of benefits to everything you just said, but this whole idea of, yeah, like a company observing my emailing habits to know, you know, how many internal versus external emails am I sending? What is my average response? I mean, shoot, I wish Gmail would do that for me and tell me, you know, how my response, and like, hey, we've noticed that your response rate has been lower. And like, that's one thing, but a company at a corporate level watching my emails and saying that, to me, that's like even more anxiety, right? Like, I don't know.
You're right.
How are you addressing that?
100%. And I think it's an important topic. By no means do we provide that kind of big brother surveillance solution. Even in cases that customers are asking for it, I know that that's not the customer I want to work with. So there are a few aspects to it. First of all, and again, I think we're here because Simon Sinek has published something about Watercolor and we're working with him. It's the why. Starting with why, as he always say, we are there to protect the employees way before we're there to help the management or the company make another buck or two. That's the purpose. And in that way, no way or there's no capability to look at an individual. So we're talking about teams. We're talking about 5-10 people, aggregated data. That's the lowest granularity that our customers would normally get. Everything is fully anonymized. Again, we don't want customers abusing our product and, you know, harming people because of a certain behavior. So team level only, fully anonymized, with a purpose or mission to make employees safe in working environments, in their work environments. In addition to that, the price of not looking at my workforce, I think, is higher. If you have a manager that is overworking, abusing, pushing their team to a limit, what would be preferred? You know, people ending up, best case, leaving the company, worst case, in a hospital like I did. And again, you see these behaviors in the data.
Everyone supports a culture of well-being in the field and is equipped with the tools to help prevent suicide in construction. Procore Safety Qualified courses were built in partnership with our customers, elevating enhancements to their standard OSHA training. And the Bringing the Right Mindset series equips individuals and leaders alike with the skills necessary to really build resilient teams. We've made these three courses available for free and on demand, and they're offered both in English as well as Spanish, and they are CEU certifiable. Procore.com/certified-qualified is where we host our Procore's learning portal, and anyone can use their Procore credentials or create a free account to get started.
So we probably have to break this down like a little bit further from a, like, just an architectural perspective, so everybody kind of understands what Watercolor does. But as far as I understand it, Watercolor sits on top as an aggregate of your HR systems, things like Gmail or Outlook or SharePoint, but also possibly in our world, and this is what connected me with Eitan, because, you know, there was this outside of construction, there's not an understanding of how much digital work we do. And I think we're also primed for, we're very remote, right? By design, construction happens in the field outside of purview, which it's very difficult to understand that landscape. So it's kind of cool to see how this platform it's sitting on top of all of that and understanding a kind of learning behavior and then aggregating that information to start to give predictive, I'll call it predictive analytics for a better word, but sort of triggers and predictions around what might be happening in certain groups. Correct what I got wrong there.
No, I think you got it all right, except when we look at those IT systems, going, Nathan, back to your question, it's important to say that we never, ever look at any content of anything. It's just the metadata, the usage pattern.
Yeah. And explaining that is important, right? I mean, there's so much in our industry of like this fear of data sharing. It's like, hey, there's a difference between usage data transparency and content data. Like we're not looking at what you're writing. We're just looking at how many you're writing and maybe how long it's taking. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, I think the right terminology would be behavioral analytics, right? So looking at numbers that describe how are people in my organization using the various IT systems? How do they utilize them, right? What's the frequency? Time of the day? Is it business hours only? Is it beyond business hours? Is it middle of the night? Is it something that wasn't there before, right? Last week or a couple of weeks ago? So it's looking at the usage patterns from various different systems, combining it with HR data. HR data is important because you see managerial changes having a great impact on the team's satisfaction, right? If someone changes a manager every quarter, every 4 months, something feels shaky, right? It's like my parent who is continuously changing roles. Looking at tenure, looking at adjacent departure, looking at vacation days utilized. So combining all of these, to provide talent or risk prediction. And when I say risk, to me, it has two meanings. I'm risking my people because I'm burning them out without even knowing. Just happening to be a micromanager, I'm not aware of it. Or risk in a company level, that people in this area of the business has a high burnout risk or leaving, you know, flight risk. So
I think that's it's an important component too, because, you know, when you tell your own story, it's not, I don't think common knowledge and Nathan, we can sort of go back to our experience with Sobelt and some others that like, it's really the high performers in your organization that are at some of the highest risk for this to happen. So you're talking about some of your top level talent that, like you said, it's on your 29 and just going, right? Well, eventually when ulcerative colitis hit you, you weren't 29 anymore. You're probably 10 more years along the way, but you were driven by something else, by your high performance, by the belief in the company, by the hours that you put in. And what if, you know, and so many of these folks, Nathan, as we know in our world, are outside of purview. They're working on whether it's the project management, the schedule, the, you know, whether they're modeling or detailing. You know, we hear this from detailers consistently that, you know, they have a ton of work. It has to be perfectly accurate or someone's life's at risk, right? But all the while creating risk by overworking and no one knowing it's happening. So it's a critical component.
And I think that no one knowing is the main issue here, because it's okay to work hard. It's okay to have stressful kind of project with tight deadlines. The question is, if anyone is noticing, if anyone is managing that, it's okay to have a peak kind of quarter, but is it followed by kind of a 2 weeks downtime in a way, recovery time? And that's also something that you see in the data. You see those teams that are kind of, you know, they have this sinusoidal wave of high performance, could be the end of the quarter for a sales team, but then there's some kind of a recovery time. And my goal is for every manager to start looking and providing that recovery time. Let me tell you another story how I got this kind of idea. selling my previous company was a hard, long deal, about 6 months. And I was working hours on hours and hours, weekend, right? My digital footprint would be all over the place. And we got to the end, we signed the deal, we were acquired, we sold the company. And the first thought I had is, those legal counsels that I had with me, they were working just as hard as I did, if not harder. For them, I was just another deal. After me, they have another one. So I thought to myself, Jesus, do they continue that kind of workload after our project, after me? And that's kind of got me again thinking on these recovery times.
That perfectly matches the detailer scenario in our world. It's right from one job to the next. It's the same with the scheduler, right from one job to the next. And usually our highest performers, our you know, SEAL Team 6, so to speak, is moved from fire drill to fire drill to fire drill without paying attention to the cost to the employee until one of two things happens. They leave. Or like you said, the worse, they end up in the hospital. And unfortunately, that's not an untold story in our world. So I'm interested in spinning this a little bit towards, you know, it's all about why, right? So, but, you know, what do we do? You know, why is because we want employees to have tenure, balance in life, balance in work, reduce risk for our organizations, reduce risk from employee loss, but also from, you know, issues. You know, people at certain points of burnout don't do the best work and aren't cognizant of it. You know, this might be in our world, this might be somebody whose digital footprint is showing that, wait, they're working 6 hours and also deployed on site for 8 hours in a day, is working basically 14 hours a day and could be, you know, in physical risk. So, but now we know why. And so how is the data? How are we taking and getting information and then turning around and helping our teams? How are you presenting that?
Perfect. And I'll just add another anecdote here that in one of our discussions with an industrial, it's a paper mill, right? So paper manufacturer, they deliberately or explicitly asked us to incorporate safety incidents data. I don't want to get too technical, but basically when we start working with and onboarding a new customer, we look at about 200 metrics generated from all these data sources, 200 data points or KPIs. And we then look at the history of the company, about 1 or 2 years historical data. Normally it's there. I mean, most of the data is collected and just sits there without us even knowing or paying attention to it. So we have the AI algorithm start looking at the history, start looking for those patterns, for those correlations, looking at, you know, we have 50 or 500 people that left the company in these 2 years. Let's see how their digital footprint looks like before 9 months before they left or before they burn out. And this is the power of AI, looking at all those hundreds of data points, looking for endless number of correlations and finding those who are found to be the most significant or has the highest statistical significancy. And with that training done, completed, let's now use those lessons learned from looking at the history to look at present day. And if now the AI models, the algorithms, would start identifying similar patterns at their nascency, at their early days, they could with high probability say, look, we started seeing this pattern in that specific team in this specific site. That similar pattern was seen 3, 30, 50 times before, and it led to people burning out, to people leaving, to people injuring themselves or getting injured at work. I think it's better that you pay some attention to that specific team and those specific KPIs. This is in a very high level how it works.
So I have a question. I'm not an expert in HR platforms, and I'm curious, as you look at the data that's available from platform to platform, because everybody, you know, Workday is one of the big ones and some other ones. But when it comes to like trying to capture some of those softer skills, whether it's a DISC profile or a Myers-Briggs or some of those other items, or like ways you can like better understand someone and maybe potentially create some correlations or other things, I think is kind of where I'm going with it. I guess, is that something where you're able to get that much data, or are there differences in the amount of data you're able to get from different platforms? Like how hard is it to get HR data? I feel like it'd be pretty locked up, but maybe not if it's within the company.
And so Myers-Briggs is very personal, right? So it's not the type of data that we're after. We're mostly looking at, first of all, again, everything is fully anonymized.
Yeah, I was going to say it is personal, but it's also a team thing too, because it can be personal. But I think the intention is that it, and maybe Myers-Briggs is a bad example because that one can be, but there are other ones that are, well, StrengthsFinder is a good example. So like the StrengthsFinder is one that is more of like a public facing one. And so I guess that was where I was curious if, because I've seen efforts where projects, at least at a project level, have tried to track like what is the StrengthsFinder. In fact, they print them on their badges so that when you come in, you kind of know what people's like, they're a communicator, they're an arranger, they're a whatever, and they actually use those types of things. Like I was wondering if that was anything you tried to incorporate at all.
No, the answer is no. Again, the HR data that we use is more of the descriptive call it very high level, kind of age, tenure, internal mobility. How often do you move to different roles? How often does your manager is replaced? Vacation days
you learn. Who your manager is. What about who your manager is? Because that could always, you know, again, that gets tricky on the big brother thing.
But exactly.
Knowing trends
exactly,
of like
exactly.
How many people left the same manager.
So we do see that. We can show companies where, and even more than that, if you incorporate applicant tracking system data, so you start looking at the data footprint from the moment of interviews, and you can learn, who are my strong interviewers that if they took part in the interviewing process, the people that they hired stick longer, right? Yeah, and also where in my company do managers lose people? And that too is something that we can see in the data. By the way, not to say that this is a bad manager that should be fired. This is a manager that probably needs some help. And here is some personalized leadership coaching program, because we know for that specific manager what kind of specific issues their people are struggling with.
Well, and actually that's what I love about Simon Sinek's article they did on your website around this concept of should you work on the weekends or not. And the, you know, of course, Simon's starting with this mindset of, well, of course we have to have balance and you shouldn't work on the weekends, and almost kind of making this mandate. And I again am one that, similar to Simon, share the ADHD superpower, and that, you know, some days during the day I don't want to work, and that I feel guilty, and that I feel like I need to work on the weekend, and I feel better after I do work on the weekend. And like, why should that be a bad thing? Because I took time off during the week, and it's this whole concept of a results-oriented work environment, and, that, and that's okay, right? But it almost took him realizing that the policy that he had created based on his why was actually not aligned with the same why of others. So that was just such an aha moment for me.
And it was an aha moment for me too, and for many others. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What is results oriented work environment? What does that mean for construction, where maybe you do have, hyper performers that just, I don't know, have no life and they just love this stuff. And if you know that about them, then fine. But, you know, maybe there are others that want to put up that facade because they think that's what our industry is asking them to do, but really underneath they don't feel that way and they are, you know, up against burnout. And yeah, like how do you pull that out when they don't necessarily want to tell you up front? I think sounds like you're working on that.
So maybe just a word about that research. So first of all, it's an initial research that we've done with about data coming from about 7,000 employees from in that case, I think it was four or five different companies. And some interesting findings, some surprising findings like this one that Simon wrote about, and we recently just had a webinar on some other findings. But I think the main conclusion that I had from this particular finding was that, and again, I'm taking it a bit to the extreme, but as a manager, I want my people to be able to do whatever they want and, you know, work as much as they want and don't work or work whenever they feel like working. Of course, that it has to be as long as we you know, get to our goals and right. do whatever it is from a business perspective that we need to do. But in a high level, in a very conceptual kind of spiritual way, let them do whatever they want to do.
And that's that. Here's a question that you may or may not have an answer to. Like, how much of burnout is tied to inflexibility of your work versus just the demand itself? Like, if there's so much demand for the, it doesn't matter what sort of results-oriented work environment, if there's too much demand, you're going to burn out. Versus your burnout could be based on just your frustrations with the inflexibility of the system that you're working in, right?
Yeah, and again, I have to say that I'm an engineer, so I haven't gone into formal organizational psychology trainings, but I think it's a combination of stressors. They're actual measurable stress factors, and then our personality, how do we respond to those? And yes, sometimes it's very definitive. Extreme workload, which is quantifiable, and you can see it for a long period of time, people will burn out, but they will burn out in different rates. So for me, I actually like to be stressed, but again, not for too long periods of time, right? So I'm managing it for myself.
That's so funny. Yeah, I talk about that with my therapist. That, you know, without anxiety, I can't be productive. If there's not a deadline, if there's not something looming, I'm just going to sit around and be lazy because that's my natural state. It's the complete opposite of my wife, but you know, we are the way we are. And it's like understanding that is how you solve that. So when you do this research with Adam Grant, just to make sure I get some credit for it.
Simon.
That sounds like awesome.
Simon.
No, organizational psychology would be Adam Grant.
Adam Grant.
His worthy rival and close.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's the interesting part, right? Nathan's talking about his procrastination monkey in his head, and each of us understanding how that works from the organizational psychology perspective, though, because I do think there's going to be layers of that as you guys grow through this experiment as it is, you know, one of the things you hit there, Eitan, is you were like, well, I kind of want them to do whatever. That's autonomy. If they have autonomy and mastery, you have satisfaction. Like, there are certain combinations required for people to excel, and they have to be met in different places. So this brings me to like another portion of what you were studying, Eitan, is like your platform doesn't say you're a manager, you should touch every person 3 times a week this way. It actually monitors those interactions, layers those on with a bunch of other data points, and starts to give you this understanding of like, this is how many times, or this is where. These are ways to coach a manager who thinks they're being helpful. And they're creating stress, because I know my manager is going to call me every 8 a.m. every morning. So 9 o'clock every night, I'm going to do this checklist of crap that I probably don't have to do. So there's some of that involved in what you guys are building.
Yeah. And again, this is coming from my own personal questions or pains. When I first started managing people, on the one hand, you don't want to be the micromanager that intervenes every 10 minutes and check up, continuously checking up on the people. On the other hand, you know, while I believe people should do whatever they want to do, I do want to have some kind of managerial understanding and control that we're all aligned. So I continuously many times ask myself, personally on myself, where is the balance between overmanaging and undermanaging? There is a risk in both. I mean, if I'm overmanaging, my people will get upset, showing them I'm not trusting them. That's micromanagement. But if I don't speak with them enough, they'll feel neglected, right? I don't care about what they do. They're not important. So where is the fine line? Where's the balance? And here too, looking at data from a few hundred employees from, I think, 1,000 even in various different companies, you see the pattern emerges. When you look at all the people that left the company in the last 2, 3, 5 years, and when you start looking at how frequent was there an interaction with their manager? Interaction would be over Slack, significant email correspondence, one-on-ones with my manager, even meetings with multiple participants. But we have the ability to get a baseline or even a proxy to the level of manager interaction. Long story short, in a particular company, we saw that not surprisingly, that if managers in that company do not speak at all with their people over the course of a week, zero engagement, those people are at a higher risk of leaving the company because of lack of manager interaction. And in that same company, managers that would interact with their people 3 to 7 times a week, 7 meaning over weekend too, right? 6 and 7 is probably weekend. Their people are also at a higher risk of leaving the company. So 0 are at a high risk. 3 to 7 are at a high risk. There is a dramatic drop in the risk level if managers engage with their people once or twice a week in that particular company. It's actually like a U curve. So you see that in the data.
I can hear it in my life's experience, to be honest, Eitan. I can hear it because I understand that, especially as somebody who's been remote for 10 years. I can look back at those interactions and the different managers and people I've had and the levels of interaction and know, I've many a time been like, would anybody even know if I was still alive or not at a company? Or would you just get off my back? Like, I'll get, you know, I've got this and I'll get it done. So I think you guys are, you know, really layering a fantastic data set that I can just see over time really starting to inform managers of how to connect and keep people connected and also look for those patterns and manage those patterns. Because it's not like the ebbs and flows aren't going to happen. Business gets stressful at times, right? It's supposed to. That's the way this stuff works. I mean, none of it's easy. So and in fact, hard work is valuable, and it's what drives a lot of people's why is solving really hard problems. You look at construction, you know, delivering very complicated projects on a, you know, a shortened time frame and schedule is a powerful why. You know, this a lot of why people do what they do in our construction world. But we're not realizing that if we're not balancing that, then we're going to lose them. And in the end too, that's, you know, we talk about you're not really getting involved too much in cost, but the cost of losing an employee is just so high. You lose the knowledge. You lose the morale. I mean, there's so many connected ripples that happen when people come and go. I can just see so many different ways to utilize this data. And what I like too is, you know, we were talking about this before, you've got some core systems, HR systems that you're going to need. You know, there's a communication systems. You mentioned Slack, I'm sure, Teams, SharePoint, Google Sheets. But you're also able to, as long as the system has an API, connect to it and start to grab that same metadata. 100%. So when you guys think about our world, you think about, you know, the Procores of the world, you think about the Autodesks of the world.
There's your HR, right? Yeah. All the HR data is in there.
Yeah. You get, you get the, you know, the Autodesks, your authoring tools and detailing tools. You get your Procore, your project management tools, your field tools, your safety tools. Now you can overlay that with your other interconnected systems and start to paint a picture, which, by the way, construction has been dealing with this forever, right? We live in this weird lights on world. You know, like, I don't know if you've heard this in our world, but like if your office light's not on, your trailer light's not on, you're not working. But I honestly think that's a byproduct of how helpless it has to be and feel to be at a high enough level to have enough people in your organization to not be able to know. You said it about yourself earlier. In your world, like, how do I know how they are? I think many times our reaction, you know, we try to limit as many things as we possibly can when we're feeling out of control. So it's, you got to be in the office or you got to be online or, you know, but if you give them data and insight, you release them from some of that. And I'm seeing the power in how this can all kind of come together in our world.
Yeah. So I think first of all, you touched the very good point that as long as there's data and there's a way to get the data, we're there. Let's use the data. We have a customer that we incorporated clocking systems, right? Because they work in shifts. We have another customer, more of a software organization. So we incorporate code management or source code management system. So any system that has a signal in it and has the data in it, and again, most of the time the data just sits there, the usage data, right? The usage metrics, not the content. The content is used for sure. Let's put it in use. Let's put it in use to take better care of our people. It's relatively easy when you think about it.
Well, and I think this is where this whole data thing becomes interesting, because anytime you're talking about data about people, I think that's why I get always get so skeptical. And we were talking on the last episode about my discomfort with data, that I'm much more of a, you know, tell me a story and I'll believe you kind of side of the world. But I do think that, yeah, when you have data that you can trust, you can back up, but you can also, again, layer in. We keep using this word layer. And I keep coming back to, I've seen companies and seen organizations that are really successful with building team chemistry because they do those personality profiles in their onboarding. And like to look at your scatter plots and see, yeah, the normal average is this range, but on the ones that are outside of those ranges, we can actually see, oh, well, they're this personality profile type versus this one. So it actually makes sense why they would be outside of that normal range. And you can start to get that more of that understanding of the nuance of why those outliers exist, and even do that much more trending off of it, right?
And now, Nathan, you're bringing me to a very interesting concept, because I've been doing this for 10 years now, but you're two quote ways to look at a specific problem. One, and again, coming from data science and AI, it's the data science way. Let's look at the data. Let's let the algorithms run and find the patterns. And then there's the kind of the expert, the
Socratic, you could say, like a Socratic method, but like, yeah, like you're guiding yourself a little bit, but you're still checking your questions. Yeah, it's much more art than it is science, probably.
Yeah, and what I'm saying, I feel, and I've done it in the past, I'll tell you more about it shortly, but combining that or hybriding between the data science and the expertise or the soft skills and the academic research and the org psychology, I think this is where things come in or becoming very powerful, because you just gave an example here without even meaning that let's look at data patterns and now let's correlate that with the personality analysis or the Mayer-Briggs that everybody or the type of communicator. So combining human expertise with AI, this is the way to go forward. Maybe tying it back to my previous life as a predictive maintenance, right? Looking at data that machines generate, looking at data coming without even knowing what the machine is doing. I don't know if it's a pump or if it's a turbine or if it whatever. We see an abnormal behavior in that machine because the data shows that. Now, fusing that with an expert that it could tell us, yeah, this is a ramp-up time or this is a shutting down process, enhances the capability of the algorithms. So similar to what you just said, Nathan.
I see this as this really interesting puzzle, because I go to my marketing and sort of testing background as an IT person. Talk about, this is going to be incredibly capable of understanding as you roll things out, like team chemistry exercises, maybe I wouldn't call it perks, but you know, ways to test out trying to get a team to work better together. Those are the things you're not going to capture that necessarily in the data up front, but the results of a group that's your I would call it, you know, your control versus your test, you can see if it's having a positive impact, how those soft skills, how that organizational psychology, yeah, how different teaming methodologies are working for you, and also different leadership styles. You know, we're in this and I'll bring my third favorite person in that group of, you know, you have Simon, you have
Adam,
and then you have Brené. And it's Brené is leaning into this ability to lead with empathy, to lead with vulnerability, to really, you know, get into a different area. You're, yeah, there you
there's
go.
And you can, yeah.
you can now see it, where your daring, vulnerable leaders in early phases of their careers, you can lean into them that are changing your culture. And the data is proving that they're having these impacts, right? For me, data and feelings and testing all has to line up to drive to an end game.
You guys, it's like you have access to all my information on my PC and brain, because when I speak with people, I think it's part of our sales deck that we're not there to replace your gut feelings. We're not there to replace body language and personal interaction and eye contact. We're there to enhance it.
In fact, if they don't provide the gut in the first place, there's nothing to react to, right? Like you can't give them an answer if they didn't give you a question in the first place, right?
Exactly. And I'll even add, Jeff, to what you said, that one of the problems that we see speaking and working with our customers is that they have no idea, in most cases, what is the impact of well-being programs or of leadership training programs. They don't. They just do it. Once a year, you know, they do it. Now, we actually see in the data, how is the behavior changing? And one of the issues that you see is that it's changing for a couple of months or 3 months after the training. And then it goes back to less productive. Now you have the ability to track and to make sure that you're in the green zone, in the safe zone, not just once a year, but long periods of time.
For those organizational psychologists, for those daring leaders, it provides the valuable data to continue to do those things. There's so much of like this, oh yeah, well, employee wellness, yeah, we did that thing, you know, tacos that day. No, this is a continuous plan. This is leadership training. It's emotional training. It's therapy. It's also healthy balance in life. Are you taking enough time off? Is our time off policy? You know, how many times have we gone back and forth in the software world and I guess other worlds with this, oh, unlimited time off. Take what you need. That works. No, it doesn't. Or maybe it does. I don't know. It's actually
a
correlation.
Do you have a culture that guilt trips people into working too much anyway? Like, yeah, that gets into personalities and relationships and all that stuff.
And it drives one more thing that those feeling people like me need is that's the correlative data that, yeah, this is working, or no, it really isn't. Or possibly if you're talking, you know, a large organization, well, it's working in these pockets and not in these pockets. Yeah. What is different about those pockets? This is just like, so if you're listening from the construction side, we talk about this all the time. If I have 16 jobs going and I'm trying to look at all 16 jobs, I'm not going to know anything about any of them. And quite frankly, most of them are going well. I need to know the 25% of those jobs that are having some sort of problem so I can focus on those problems, because those are the ones that in the end will hurt me. They will hurt me the most and they can tank me. You know, I had this early on, I had a construction executive tell me, look, if I do 10 projects and 9 of them go well and 1 of them tanks, I could lose my company. So I need to focus on the 1. Same thing is true here. So again, it's focusing a limited amount of resource. Most of those leaders are trying to look at too much. Look at where the problems are. And like you said, it's not about looking and bringing some hammer down. Your software is not telling them, here's the hammer, hit it. It's telling them, here's where you need to focus. Here's some of the things we know. What can we work together as leaders, as people, to understand what's going on and make adjustments?
What you've just said, again, it's very much incorporated in our product and user interface, because we understand people and managers are stressed. They're busy. They have, you know, juggling million balls in the air at the same time. And I don't expect people to start consuming complicated dashboards and data. We have 5 insights. These are your most burning topics. The sales team in North America have been working for 12, 14 hours a day for the last quarter. Their manager is a bit disengaged and not speaking with them. You better touch base with them. Send an HR business partners to speak with that manager. And, you know, so very, very targeted and very precise insights. That's the list of five things that you should work. You should care about your people and, of course, the business.
Well, I think we go down this rabbit hole for quite a while, but I am going to have to say it's time to wrap it up. Hey, Tom, where can people go find out more that are interested in Watercooler and you in general?
Watercooler.ai. That's it. You can click the button there, request a demo, and we'd be happy to have the conversation.
I highly recommend and would love to hear from any construction company out there that's reaching out, because I think it's the perfect timing for everything we have going in our industry. And Eitan, I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule, hearing out my craziness, and sitting down and talking to me. And Nathan as well.
This was fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Thank you very much again for giving us the opportunity, or giving me the opportunity, to speak about these important topics.
Keep up the great work, my friend. We think we really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff. Nathan, I truly enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you for tuning in today. Welcome to a special Construction Technology News of the Week, where I'm joined by Jonathan Marsh, Travis Voss, and Nathan Wood. That's right. The crew is bringing you the news today. All right, Nathan, specialty group getting together. You know, we were talking about some news on the old Slack channels and thought, why don't we do this sucker live? So here we go, man. How you doing?
I love it, man. I love Jonathan and Travis are here. I got some trade contractor questions for you, because we've been talking about this guy, Pete Stavros, that keeps coming up in news. I've seen him on 60 Minutes, which is the CBS news article I found. I know he's got a Freakonomics episode recently, as well as other sort of messages here. But the title of this article is Private Equity's Unlikely Champion for Giving Workers a Leg Up with Employee Ownership. So as I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, private equity has a trend, or a connotation with being pretty harsh and sort of being cutthroat and not necessarily being good to the companies that they buy. A lot of trade contractors, manufacturers are usually the targets of what private equities typically like to do, and own those companies for 5 to 7 years, and then ideally sell them for a profit. And so this guy, Pete Stavros, is trying to sort of change that culture, change that game, and insert, if those who may have heard of, an ESOP, or an employee stock ownership program. So again, this is a very small one, maybe 10 to 15% that he gives to the companies that they buy. But whether it's manufacturers or trade contractors, they're sort of inserting this ownership program to those that do stay. You know, again, most of the leadership probably does get cut out, and it is really just the workers that stay. But again, what's their incentive to stay? Now they've got sort of this employee stock ownership program, which is a cool concept. I mean, again, I know folks have ideas on this on other, and not every all private equities are the same. But I think one of the options, and one of the things, especially, I know, Travis, you also listened to the Freakonomics episode that they sort of argued for, is, you know, why not just, if you're a company looking to sell, at sort of as leadership gets older and looks for who buyers are, to really look at that employee stock ownership program as an option instead of private equity. Jonathan, I know you have a lot of thoughts, but I'm going to start with Travis. Because you'll go on forever.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep it a little bit simple then, because, you know, I did listen to that particular episode. I think it was actually a kind of attack on bonus episode to a series they had done earlier in the year that focused on veterinary healthcare, I think is the industry that they were looking at. And I think what it boiled down to me was, I kind of came out of it feeling like, you know, I don't know, like, Some of them, obviously, we know stories that have gone very, very bad, both for the employees and for the company in general. It sounded like in the episode that I think you got yours from CBS, but from the Freakonomics episode, it sounded like he is really kind of trying to take a new and intuitive look at it. And he actually, they actually interviewed some of his detractors, and they had positive things to say in general. Now, I think that when you talk about ESOP, you know, obviously, you know, there are creative ways to get that cash and give money out without actually taking direct investments from the employees. It just, I mean, when you have somebody there ready to write you a big check, I'm sure it's really hard to just be like, nah, like, we'll figure out something else.
Yeah, at least to get you to think about the what's in it for me, right? But Jonathan, right, I know you got a lot of thoughts.
I really think employee-owned business is a really strong strategy within construction in particular. And we have, you know, you go to any event, you have a lot of people that are looking up to how do we pass this on to our kids? How do we pass down the business? They might even be third, fourth generation. And there is a level at which those people that they're passing down to may have not originally wanted to be in contracting. And so if someone's coming around that is part of a focused equity firm that is buying up contractors, they may actually have a good management system behind them that's going to help improve where that contractor is at today. And by bringing in the employees, it does give them some level of ownership. The problem for me comes with the track record. So the track record does not usually meet up to that press with the sort of private equity. Private equity often has the ability to go into tremendous debt. They often set, you know, sort of requirements for how we're going to run our business that may not be relevant to the geography they're in, the culture of the company. Turnover rates with private equity are very high. So I think matching it with an EOB is the brilliant part of the article, right? It's not just coming in and saying, I'm going to change the way you are doing business. It's coming in to say, we are going to change the way that you are doing business. And I think that's really positive. I think for me, it's one of those wait and see. You know, I think that you need some good players in this. You need some good people about it. I think we all, you know, we all comment on tech, right? And it's tough for me to pick a company that got acquired in the tech world where I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy you got acquired because your product got so much better, you know? And that's not every time, but it's enough, right? That it gives you sort of a weird feel. So, you know, definitely in reading the article and in listening to both of you in our discussions, I think the private equity piece for the employees is really powerful combined with an overall, you know, buying power of some of these equity companies. But private equity doesn't have a great track record.
Yeah. And I think point counterpoint in that, because you make a great point on software. I cannot think of a software acquisition that ended positive for at least for the users of the software that got acquired. But I do think that a private equity investment is different than a software acquisition. And again, just point counterpoint, talking to GCs, I have heard at least their perception, may not be reality, but perception is that, man, I wish I could find, you know, all the trade contractors that were owned by private equity, because their experience seems to be really positive, that they do bring sort of a structure and an order and sort of that they do bring benefits on that side. So again, who knows?
Yeah, you guys hit on a really interesting group of things here. But first, I'm going to take us back so that folks listening, like, there's a couple of different ways to fund companies these days. And on this show, usually you hear us talking about the venture capital and the bootstrappers. And what I thought was cool about this is that, you know, private equity is one of those players, and it is an alternative route to the, you know, VC world and the bootstrap world. What I thought was cool is it gives you an opportunity to look at the number of different ways you can not only fund a company, but if you think about it, John, in your point there, a lot of people do leave when the company is acquired. Why stay? What's in it for me to go to a Nathan, a Wyffum? What's in it for me? Well, I think Stavros is saying, listen, there's some really good business and financial ideas on why we can keep them to stay. And, oh, by the way, get improvement, bring some of our knowledge as an organization and structure, but then get you to buy in, because at the end, if we get through the 6 to 7 years and we sell for a profit, you're going to get a part of that. So there's incentives in it. It's not, you know, quite ESOP, but it's a pretty cool alternative. And at least And let's be honest, I don't think anywhere in there, Nathan, in the CBS article or in the Freakonomics, does he say, hey, this isn't self-serving. Like I think he's pretty clear about that.
Absolutely. No, yeah. I think the storyline was when they weren't doing this, that there were employees on the supply chain that were like sabotaging things. Like, again, because they had no reason not to. And it's just, yeah, whatever. They can come up with a reason. But yeah, give them a reason to not sabotage is a big part of it. Absolutely.
Sometimes a positive or a good business model is being a nice guy.
Hey, part of the business model, right? Who knew, you know, especially in our new world too, like leaning into that's a pretty powerful thing to be able to lean into and say, hey, I'm going to do these things for you. And for me, by the way, I win here as well.
Right.
And can drive some good outcome and some transparency. So it's a cool model. And I think John, you brought this up. Like you've been predicting this for a while. You think a lot of that is coming in the trade partner world right now in the trades market, that you're going to see a lot of private equity come in and buy up a lot of these family owned companies, to your point, that don't have a succession plan for, you know, the next group that they maybe don't even want it.
And we also have to look at the mega projects. We talk about that a lot. Contractors right now are partnering with one another to do a mega project. So if you can get someone come in private equity and partner together or group together a bunch of small contractors, you now have, you know, a firm capable of taking on some of those mega projects without all of the extras of trying to figure out how to get, you know, 3 plumbing contractors and 5 HVAC contractors, 6 electrical contractors onto a single job site. So I think there are a lot of upsides. Again, I think the track record is the thing we need to watch and how it goes moving forward. And also, you know, I don't know where you guys are at. Maybe you're in more dense areas, but a lot of the people work in shops. They've lived in the same geography their entire life. So when that sells next time, they kind of got to go with it. So that idea of the instability of knowing that this is being prepped for a sale in 7 years and for new ownership. Now you might be part of it or you might get money from it, but that level, and I don't know in reading the article if there was any voting stock in your, you know, EOB, but that's also another way that you know, you can structure differently. You can have EOBs with voting stock or without voting stock. It would be, I can't imagine he gave them voting stock.
Yeah, I cannot imagine it was any voting stock.
No, it was just a bonus.
I don't even think that's a bad idea. I just, that not giving them voting stock, it's just something to think about when you look at those.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's great. Any chance, I'm just sitting here thinking about this, any chance you also see or think equity might come in and make some of these things we've predicted around the, you know, the M, E, and P, the big one, like creating conglomerates that can handle these mega projects. These mega projects, you know, the GCs can JV them and it works pretty well. Because I think they're tackling expertise in areas that they can tackle. But when you're talking about MEP and partnering together, that's pretty tricky. Do you think it's an opportunity to see some of that?
I think you'll see some of it. I think one of the biggest challenges a lot of these contractors have, I mean, obviously the workforce challenge, but it's the bonding. So if you have, you know, something with a big financial backing, it's much easier to get bonding then. I do think that there's probably some potential there for that.
The when I was working with them and doing the prep work and everything for some of the, there was a couple of private equities trying to set up multi-trade shops. And we did sort of determine that in certain geographies, you're not going to be able to get the unions to agree to this type of an arrangement. So there's some headwinds against them on that part. But yeah, for the mega projects, bringing together 3 or 4 contractors, or if you have a location, you know, I live in Erie, you could probably purchase all the contractors in Erie. And now we're right in the middle of Buffalo, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, and we're the biggest contractor in town with no local competition. You know, I mean, there's very strategic things they can do to really make them more strategically important. Is that how they're going to make their money? You know, it's all track record.
All right. Last question to ponder is, do private equity prefer to buy union or non-union contractors?
I don't know.
That, if anybody's listening, non-union, but I don't know. That's just because there's more freedom and flexibility, but I could be wrong. Yeah. Anyone that knows an answer, hit us up.
Yeah. Hit us up. That's why I wanted to bring, you know, the four of us together to talk about this kind of stuff. Cause it does ask some really good questions. I don't think we have all the answers. So if you're in private equity and listening, give us a shout, drop us a line, you know, we're here to talk. So awesome. Thank you for that one, Nathan. Travis, what do you got today?
Well, it's kind of funny. We were just talking about how, you know, what happens traditionally when a software company buys or acquires another software company. And I brought up that Trimble recently acquired, I got to get the name again, FlashTrack, which is a payments and compliance platform that they're going to fold into their flagship project management software, their Vista by Viewpoint, or Viewpoint, I think it's just Vista now, that the ERP solution that they purchased. And I mean, obviously, again, we've seen the explosion of construction technology point solutions. Now we're seeing the contraction. And I really brought this one up for a couple things. You know, Procore's done something similar. Autodesk did something similar earlier this year. I expect these sorts of things to happen. And I think it's really appropriate that Nathan's here, because my bigger concern still is, now we had a lot of talk probably, you know, what, Nathan, even 5 years ago, with all the software companies were going to kumbaya and share data and be easy to work together. But, you know, sometimes the proof is in the pudding. And I just keep seeing these acquisitions telling me that we're still trying to shove people into one environment. I want to build one massive platform that I want everybody in construction to exist on. And I do think it makes it a little bit harder for less interoperability and the sharing of data. So I'll kick it right to Nathan.
There. And coming fresh off of CFMA, where they were demoing this at the Trimble station, Procore is there in full force with Procore Pay. And a lot of these different, you know, financial.
Well, we can't leave out Oracle either. I mean, that's kind of the big four there, right?
Mm-hmm. And Sage recently acquired a new project management solution that, again, they're integrating as well. So I don't think you can stop any of these larger guys from wanting to acquire the full suite of solutions for.
And I'm not
any
sure we
given
want to. It's
stakeholder,
just...
yeah. But ultimately, what we still get at, and where CPC and where the CDX efforts exist, is that even in that world, a trade contractor's full, you know, Trimble suite and a GC's full Procore suite or whatever that is, or even if it's a mix of things, you're still going to have to share between those two contractors, or between architects, between owners. And that's where there's that whole, that's where I create the separation between an integration and interoperability. Integrations is just how you're going to figure out your own tech stack. How a project's going to exchange those documents together is that next level interoperability. So I don't think this necessarily changes things. Hopefully they're doing this with the same, forecasting that they've been doing, you know, really since 2020, around, yes, we want to have all the different tools for a customer to use, but also recognize that other customers, that their customers work with, may use other solutions that are non-Trimble, and that they have to work with them. And it's not like they acquired Rivet and killed all of the Procore and other, like they still support and will continue to support those. It's just, they're going to have obviously a little bit different priorities now that they're a Trimble company.
I was actually looking in the background while we were talking about this, Jonathan, because you sparked it, to see if we could find software platforms that were acquired at some point and then are now somewhat ubiquitous to the platforms we use. I'm going to tell you, it didn't come out as well as I had thought. And however, you know, some interesting ones were Hotmail. It was acquired by Microsoft and is the basis of Office 365 and Outlook.com. You know, it really was some of the impetus to what you see is now Office 365. Some of the others weren't so great, but interesting. Skype as well, another Microsoft win that is now Teams, that is pretty ubiquitous, and it was based on it for a very long time. I think they took parts and pieces of it out of it to create Teams. So not as good of a history, though, man. I can honestly say, when I thought, you know, that there would be a better track record of it. And maybe somebody listening can give us a little bit better track record, because you know, with this, the Trimble one, you know, take it back to your article, Travis, this is, you know, this is a shoring up, right? Like, Procore has level set and purchase level set and does very similar things to what Fast Track does. So as Trimble's building out more of a project management suite on top of what is more of, you know, financials are core to what they do versus Procore, you know, kind of coming at it the other direction, it's a leveling and sort of a, and these are both, I think, core. And Nathan, you mentioned Oracle. I think these are core to Oracle in some of their, what Oracle SAP and others that they have. Mm-hmm. I think they're pretty core in that and doing some of this functionality that you're talking about here. So, you know, this is kind of cool because I love it when they will go to your, I always give you credit, as Jonathan has told me, it came from a book somewhere and you got it from Rick. But as we see the co-opetition, the fighting with one another, but also, ooh, I need to learn from them possibility here, it makes these platforms stronger, more robust, and capable of doing more.
I think for this particular one, they had to do this. They needed that feature set. Like mm-hmm. the cost of being in the market, you have to have certain things. And this is one of them. I think with a lot of the applications, they're required to get a feature set and a subscriber base. And that's basically it. You know, it's not particularly the functionality. It's not like it's going to be its own standalone product. It's going to be folded in to provide additional functionality. And as much as I occasionally give Trimble a hard time when they make acquisitions, there's especially around Vista and Viewpoint, they use them. Like you will, it's not something that gets thrown away. It's definitely something that we're going to hear more about. And I think that this is, again, they have a pretty solid ERP. This is a necessary, you know, necessary functionality for that, in my mind.
Yeah. And to give them credit, except for changing the name of Rivet, I think what they've done with Rivet is a good acquisition and a good part of what they've done. So it is showing them the track record there of really of leaning into to making more out of what they acquire. So that's
I kind of wanted to go back to your point too, Jeff, about trying to find stuff that's worked. I wonder how many of those acquisitions just become folded into a part of a product and that product becomes ubiquitous to us. We don't really remember the, you know, maybe even Microsoft Word was bought, or, you know, there's probably softwares like that that just become part of something that we know.
Well, within this specific topic, Textura was the original payment portal for construction that Oracle acquired. And I'm pretty sure to this day, I mean, at least people still refer to it as Textura. I think it's just Oracle Textura. And I think for the longest time, they were kind of a standalone, you know, best in market solution. So now, like, this is just an example, like you said, of Trimble needing to make sure that they're keeping up, because as you see, all these other companies incorporate their version of digital payment portals. And the reality is that the GC has to have their, you know, GC Pay or whatever they're using, and the trade still has to have theirs. I forget, there was someone there, I want to say it was Sightline, I believe, that is essentially the trade contractor's version of that says you might have one GC that uses Textura, one that uses GC Pay, one that uses Procore Pay. How do you have one portal for all of those? So it ends up, if you're thinking about your gears, it's like a four system integration to make those payments work. But it's pretty sophisticated, and it's getting rid of the redundancy and the duplicate entry. And it's a great example that I think we can model for a lot of other exchanges in the industry.
Everyone, thank you. I want to thank the crew for joining me today to do the news. I want to thank Eitan for joining us. It was great having him. Thanks to Nathan for being involved in all of it. He's always there for me. And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Eitan Vesely. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.